Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 18th of October 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we're joined today by live video Skype link with David Scott, Northern Exposure, and Alex Thompson, Eastern Approaches. And of course, Alex reporting from the depths of the Netherlands.
Happy EU Human Trafficking Day, Brian. That is today.
Good. Yes. Good. I missed that.
So here we are. Rob Wainwright, who's the British Executive Director of Europol, he has said by working together, he tweeted out, we can succeed in eradicating this heinous crime. I don't think so. He said in the quote that went with this, he said, trafficking in human beings is a global problem and a thriving criminal industry that affects the lives of millions of children, women and men around the world who are trapped in severe forms of exploitation. By working together, leveraging our concerted power and increasing the operational priority given to investigating human trafficking, the police community and civil society can succeed in eradicating this heinous crime. Well, the key point there is that, of course, it's huge quantities of money being made as a result of this, and Europol and the other agencies not getting enough money to tackle it. It's the same business model as the drugs trade, as far as I can see. Works very well for certain sections of the community, not least the financial system. But the point here, Brian, is that Rob Wainwright isn't going to do anything really to make any major impact on human trafficking. We can have these human trafficking days every year at the behest of the EU, but it isn't actually bringing the situation forward in any way.
The days are just to give the general public the feel that something's being done. It's like the major charities rattling their collection boxes that they're doing something about cancer or they're doing something about child protection, but they never actually do it. Perhaps we can remind our audience that at the moment, we, the UK Column, at the UK Column, are very confident that the British government cannot produce any single statistic for the number of children that disappear each year in UK. If you go to the National Crime Agency, they haven't got the figures. The child protection charities haven't got that figure. Wouldn't that figure be a good place to start to actually understand how many children are being who are disappearing each year?
That would seem reasonable.
Too difficult for Britain in 2017.
So where do we go from there?
Well, we come on to this happy email. Justin Walker from the British Constitution Group received this email, and this has come back with regard to the Leave the EU Immediately campaign, and this petition, sorry, is the right word. So the government has responded to questions about Leave the EU Immediately. That is the email, just to show the official thing on screen. Let's have a look at what they say. The government has responded to the petition you signed, Leave the EU Immediately. And the government says this, the country voted to leave the EU and this government respects that. A smooth and orderly exit is in the interests of both the UK and the EU. The country voted to leave the EU and the government is clear that there must be no attempts to remain inside the EU, no attempts to rejoin it through the back door and no second referendum. In leaving the EU, the government will seek the best deal for the UK, maximising the benefits from leaving the EU, control over our borders, laws and money, while maintaining the greatest possible access to EU markets and continuing to work with our European neighbours on common problems. After withdrawal, the UK will bring an end to the direct jurisdiction of the Court of Justice of the European Union in the United Kingdom. And we'll give the last little bit. The Prime Minister has been clear that the days of Britain making vast contributions to the European Union every year will end. The European Commission has set out the European Union's position on the financial settlement, and the government is undertaking a rigorous examination of the detail of this. The government has already introduced legislation to ensure that the UK exits the EU with certainty, continuity and control. A smooth and orderly exit is in the national interest, and further legislation will be introduced to deliver that. Both the UK and the EU should want to achieve the best possible outcome and the strongest possible partnership for the future. The government believes that a deep and special partnership between an independent UK and the EU is in the interests of both sides. And that's come from the Department for Exiting the European Union.
Excellent.
So notice the little mention, we need a few laws. We need a few more laws to make this happen.
Okay.
And before I give our guests a chance to comment on that, let's have a look at the department. It's here. Very fine department it is too. And here's some of the objectives. Of course, the first one is to lead the UK's negotiations to leave the EU and establish a new partnership between the EU and the UK.
Yes.
So we're leaving, but we're not leaving because we're having a new partnership. And as UK column has shown time and time again, of course, a key part of the new partnership, it will be EU military integration. So we can follow through, have a look at some of the people, encourage our audience to do this, because basically these are people who've spent most of their lives working inside the EU. Now they've suddenly realised the error of their ways and they're going to work flat out to get the UK out of the EU. This man, particularly interesting, Tom Shinner. What's his background? Well, his background is really teaching. At the moment, he's Director of Cross-Government Policy Coordination at the Department for Exiting the European Union. So he's in a very powerful position. He was previously Senior Policy Advisor to the Secretary of State for Education. But now he can deal with every government department. He's hopped from education. You're seeing it so far, Mike.
Excellent.
OK, well, we did a little bit of work on this gentleman just to see if there was anything more. We came across this from TES. I'm not sure what that stands for, but that's the source of this by Richard Vaughan. Michael Gove has appointed a 28-year-old free school founder to one of the Department for Education's top civil service roles on a salary advertised at £105,000. So this young man came out of nowhere. Gove pushed him into a big job. And then if you have a look at the rest of his background here, he did spend time, a sabbatical role at the World Bank in Washington, D.C., acting as an education specialist. So here we're seeing very interesting the mix. Why the World Bank is interested in education, Mike, I'm not too sure. But this man hops from education into the World Bank, and then the next minute he's controlling the policy for exiting the European Union.
Good stuff.
It's remarkable. Alex, we often see these young people, I've got to say that with a smile on my face, of course, young people parachuted into immensely powerful jobs by other politicians with a background in banking. Banking seems to be the key.
It is, Brian, and I thought in my silly little way that having had 8 years' experience in one of the intelligence agencies, I knew how the government and the establishment more or less worked. But it took me until I came out and started watching the UK column and reading many sources tipped by UK column viewers that I realised that the top of the pyramid is actually the banks and has nothing to do with the formal levers of government. Now, if you look up the DVM TV channel on YouTube, you'll find three parts so far with English subtitles of an interview with Ronald Barnard, the whistleblower, and he sets it out as beautifully as anyone has. 8,500 hedge fund managers wish to control the world. Many are Luciferians. They set up the Bank for International Settlements in Basel with the diplomatic immunity. It tells both the World Bank and the IMF, both twin institutions in Washington are across the road from each other, how much money supply there will be and what the spending priorities are. And that's where the education and reframing and vaccinations and whatnot comes from. And below that are the central banks. And below that, we forget the first tier of government, prime minister, the sovereign even, is only at that level. So we're down five layers before we get to actual constitutional government in this model. That is, I'm afraid, the root of the evil. And as you said yesterday, Brian, it was the banks that set up effectively the British equivalent of Phi Beta Kappa, the fraternity for, shall we say, forward-thinking leadership material students. The British version of that became Common Purpose, and it's funded by the banks.
Thank you for a really excellent summary on that. We're obviously going to have to spend more time on the issue of banking, but it is interesting to see how it's becoming ever easier to see the banks working behind the politics that is making our lives a misery.
Well, you just mentioned military unification there, Brian. Well, we've got another country now declaring its intention to join the EU's defence initiative, PESCO, being discussed at the European Council meeting tomorrow and Friday. If you're not aware of what PESCO is, have a look at the last 2 days of UK column news, and you'll get the details of that. But this is the key driver for military unification in the EU. But we have some really good defence news, Brian, really good. Fantastic defence news, because here we are. The F-35 has been cleared for takeoff. This is the UK's cutting-edge F-35 fighter jet. We don't really know how much each one of these costs. It seems to the entire project seems to cost a huge amount of money, but it's very difficult to get to grips with just what each. And I suppose
it's a moving target. We think about $123 million per aircraft.
Yeah. Well, it has been cleared for takeoff from HMS Queen Elizabeth following successful trials. There's a picture of it taking off from the ramp in the desert, because that's where you need to test takeoffs for aircraft carriers in the desert. That's the best place for it. As I say, this is the UK's cutting edge F-35, and Harriet Baldwin has said successful ski ramp trials mean the F-35 is cleared to fly from the carrier as the momentum continues for this game-changing jet. This milestone comes as our pilots and planes prepare for return from the States, ready for next year's unforgettable flight trials from the deck of the nation's new flagship. Now, the key words in that quote, it's cleared to fly from the carrier, because, of course, this was all about takeoff trials. And it says here, during the Select Commission committee session in Parliament yesterday, that Harriet Baldwin announced that the F-35 Integrated Task Force, which includes five British pilots, have now successfully completed ski ramp trials. This milestone clears the aircraft for takeoff from the deck of the carrier. There's nothing in this press release which says anything about landings. As far as I know, there have been no trials about landings. We don't know when it's going to be cleared for landings. But it can at least negotiate half of its main mission, which is safe takeoffs and safe landings, Brian.
Okay, and the bit I'll add to that, Mike, is there is not a word at the moment from the Royal Navy or the Ministry of Defence about the immense problems inside the Royal Navy. We have mentioned this time and time over many years, but big problems with manning on board the ships, technicians in very, very short supply. And this morning I have been told, and we're going to follow up on this, that at the moment there is no single ship in the Royal Navy that is fully 100% operational. All of them have some issue, whether it's related to maintenance or spares or manning or other problems, as we saw with Vigilant, which had a major breakdown of morale and discipline on board. The source who spoke to us this morning says there is not one ship that's unaffected by this.
Now, in the chat box, a comment has been made that the pilots of the F-35 must be breathless with excitement. Well, no, that's not true. They're breathless because the F-35 keeps switching off its oxygen supply and they have nothing to breathe. That's why they're breathless. Now, let's bring David Scott in at this point. David, because you sent over a video clip from a Canadian news broadcast a couple of days ago, which is calling for the return of the Avro Arrow instead of the F-35.
Yes, this was from a few years ago, but I think the movement's still live in Canada. The Avro Arrow was a plane developed by Avro in the former manufacturers of the Lancaster bomber. They've been building Lancasters in Canada during the war. They developed a considerable degree of skill, and after the war, they set up an independent company, Avro Canada. And they developed this absolutely world-beating aircraft to a spec put forward by the Royal Canadian Air Force. And it's been suggested, it was cancelled in 1959. It was manufactured, there was something like seven planes flying. It was a huge technical success and was cancelled by the Canadian government. And it's been suggested that it could, in fact, be resurrected. It was cancelled in a strange way. It was kind of destroyed. The instruction was to destroy all the drawings and all the videos. It was to be completely deleted from the memory banks. But the engineers who had spent so long working on it took a lot of the drawings home, and enough of the information survived that it could actually be resurrected. Now, when you compare it with the F-35, it gets a little embarrassing. Remember, this is a 1950s technology. It's twice as fast as the F-35. It flies far higher. It's got twice the range. As a platform for shooting at things, it seems to be enormously better.
It has many similarities in terms of its treatment by government with the TSR-2, Brian.
Absolutely. And I can say, because my father worked on the TSR-2 project, and I remember well the night he came home to say that the whole project had been suddenly cancelled by the British government. But exactly the same things as you're talking about, David. The whole of the production facilities were to be destroyed. The jigs were to be destroyed. It was clear that there was to be no possibility of this aircraft being resurrected. And the point we're really making is the destruction of these aircraft and the technology. We can leave aside the fact it was military, but it was our own governments that were destroying the progress being made. Why would they do that, I wonder?
David?
This is exactly the point. I mean, in losing this plane, Canada lost a leading edge ability in supersonic aircraft manufacture. And if they spent all of their taxpayers' hard-earned money rather than buying F-35s, which don't work, but in developing industry and ability within their own country, people are saying, well, actually, it would be cheaper because the sort of economies of scale that we're meant to have aren't coming from the F-35. And look at all the benefits we would get. Yeah.
I think we just better add in here, we are, of course, well aware that the F-35 is capable of vertical takeoff and landing. We are aware of that, so not quite comparing apples with apples. But the point is that the technology that was there many years ago simply destroyed by our own governments.
So what is the Defence Academy of the United Kingdom up to?
Well, I brought this in because originally the Ministry of Defence ran training courses for people who were going to go through to senior positions in the military. And the idea was to take people out of one service and get them, say, if you were Navy, you would go on a course which was to start to introduce problems around the Ministry of Defence, so you can understand that. But if you were Royal Navy, you would be alongside colleagues from the Royal Air Force or the Army, and you would start to learn issues that were important to them. But this was essentially training for British military people. You may get some Commonwealth people coming into these. But if you go and have a look at this Defence Academy now, which says that it's part of the Ministry of Defence, it's boasting that it's training people from 57 nations around the world, and they're working alongside Serco in leadership training. In fact, anybody can come onto one of these courses now. So what we're seeing is another slice of privatisation of British military infrastructure in order to derive profits for somebody, presumably. Have a look yourself. And I'll just move on to this one. There's a lot to discuss here, but we'll just touch on it briefly. The Red Cell has produced this policy document, B+1, Policy Priorities and Prep, that's preparation for Brexit. And what are they talking about? Well, have a look at this. Taking advantage of the opportunities for Brexit and guarding against the possible problems will require a number of laws to be passed immediately. Here we are joining up with a need for these laws. Because EU law is so nebulous, affecting every part of British public life, passing laws in the normal way will be a far too time-consuming process. There are already reports that Parliament's legislative timetable will not be able to cope with the number of tasks it will have to deal with. The government, and this is the key one, the government needs the power to make the necessary changes quickly and effectively, though not at the expense of bypassing the parliamentary process entirely.
Well, that means they're going to bypass the parliamentary process just a little bit.
Indeed. So we're going to make new laws, but don't worry, because we won't really bother with Parliament for those new laws, because we can bypass those. And then I was intrigued about this. Down at the bottom, it says immediate changes are needed so that urgently needed improvements can be made to the law that govern, amongst other things, the NHS and the intelligence services. And I thought that was a very interesting combination. Alex, perhaps you might like to comment on that. I was fascinated at the bypassing Parliament to produce laws. That's got a constitutional impact. And we're combining the NHS with intelligence services. Why would that be?
Pan-Europeanisation, Brian. President Macron of France gave the clue in the four-part tweet, which we made a slide of and tweeted out and put on the broadcast a couple of weeks ago. The fourth of his I want tweets was, the fourth was the European prosecutor. The third, I think, was we must have a European Union intelligence agency. And you do that, as with military union, by suborning and amalgamating and placing under joint alien command the existing national infrastructure and sworn officers of the nations. So that, I think, is what's going to happen. The tie-in with the NHS, I think, is simply another indication that David Ellis is bang on the money, that anything which has a large tax revenue base, health most certainly does, intelligence most certainly does, is, and this is the key bit, by decree of the city in Wall Street and Switzerland, none of which are Eurozone countries, by decree of those city-states, it is all going to be done on a pan-European basis. Much the same reason why the Sands report in 1957 said we will have one defence supplier, and then why Avro was scrapped in 59 and TSR2 in about 74. The same policy being produced, pushed by the same, what a British politician called the gnomes of Zurich, as it were, of the BIS, but again, under Anglo-American command. None of this is European policy, pure and simple. It's all being shenaniganed by the Anglos behind the scenes.
OK, well, Alex, let's see what you think about this then, because this is the Investigatory Powers Tribunal website. Now, if you remember a couple of days ago, the BBC was taking a massive dig at President Xi of China, alleging that he was building a huge surveillance state, amongst other things that they were saying about him. And I said, you know, the hypocrisy here is unbelievable, because Theresa May is pursuing this agenda herself with the utmost strength or vigour, as fast as she can possibly do it. So this is the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. And from yesterday and until tomorrow, it's holding a hearing on bulk data collection. And giving evidence was Privacy International. Now, you may have some views, people may have some views about Privacy International. Let's just make the point that it is an NGO. It is foundation funded. It receives money from the Decium Foundation, Open Society Foundations, International Development Research Centre, Oak Foundation, Ford Foundation, Esme Fairburn, all the usual suspects are in there, but perhaps they do some useful work. But we'll talk about that in a second. Now, what they are saying is that they have obtained previously unseen government documents which show that GCHQ has been collecting social media information on, potentially millions of people. But the key point that is highlighted here is that GCHQ collected and accesses this information by gaining access to the private company's databases. So they're not merely scraping this off the Twitter website, building their own data and analysing their own data. They're actually getting direct access to social media companies' databases. And this, Alex, I think is something pretty interesting. They go on to say that letters obtained by Privacy International reveal that the body tasked with overseeing intelligence agencies' activities, that's the Investigatory Powers Commissioner, was kept in the dark as UK intelligence agencies shared massive databases with foreign governments, law enforcement and industry, potentially for decades. And they say that because of Privacy International's litigation on this, the Investigatory Powers Commissioner sought immediate inspection when secret practices came to light. And they say that inappropriate and uncontrolled, stroke uncontrollable sharing with industry third parties currently remains without any proper oversight, yet some contractors have system right access rights, which could allow them to enter the agency's system, extract data and cover their tracks. Now, we have discussed this issue of the merging of the GCHQ with private organisations on previous occasions, but this is this goes well beyond what we've discussed in the past, Alex.
It's quite a shock what you're reading to me there, Mike. I don't doubt the veracity of it. It's all happened in the 8 years since I've left. So under the tenure of the last couple of directors of GCHQ, who've been of a very different mould than their predecessors, who may have been stuffy establishment chaps, but I don't think would have captained that kind of ship. So I'm beginning to see a picture of my former employer going dark. Sharing with industry is completely no-no. As I mentioned before, the other two agencies, particularly the security service, MI5, have a list, an A-list of companies to whom they share relevant information about possible compromise to their intellectual property or their personnel. That's fair enough. But this massive contractor-based stuff is spiraling out of hand. NSA, as we know from Mr. Snowden in the public domain and many other sources besides, has gone much further than that. The majority of the many thousands of people working for NSA are contractors. Most of the stuff that they have, whenever you hear the word bulk, you can assume that that is special source access, warranted access to stuff held offsite by companies. In the end, the tail wags the dog. These companies are, just as with military to mercenary relationships, it's the private guys who were a short time in public service and then off the books who are actually driving and who possess the information. And that's where the great degree of corruptibility and blackmailability is.
So, you know, what we're talking about here is not just as, you know, an agency sharing information by email or whatever with a private company. We're actually seeing GCHQ staff having direct access to private companies' computer systems, and we're also seeing private companies' staff having direct access to GCHQ computer systems. At what point do they just decide, let's merge these systems?
Well, perhaps the controlling minds, to use a legal expression, of these enterprises are one and the same. And the latter of what you put your finger on there is particularly new and unacceptable and novel, Mike. And that is, if it is true, that the contractors in the providers, in this case the social media, but the same could be said of any other telecom provider who've signed a deal with GCHQ or been forced to, that they should have access through to GCHQ systems or NSA. That really is beyond the pale. So we need to take a good hard look. And who's been Home Secretary throughout this period? Mrs. May.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. We'll just mention this briefly. The counter-terror awards are coming up. This is fantastic. And counter-terrorism police are supporting this. They're giving financial support to the inaugural counter-terrorism awards. They're going to take place next spring. And this is a competition designed to recognise the efforts of both public and private sector organisations in helping tackle terrorism and keep the public safe. Now, Alex, I would say that if the staff at GCHQ were to be asked about what they're up to and the merging of public and private in this way, they're probably going to be using keeping us all safe from terrorism as being the excuse for why they're doing it.
Oh, that's the only game in town, Mike. There's no possible pretext for the collection of such bulk data on domestic targets other than the argument of the needle in the haystack or the need to seek algorithms and patterns among the domestic extremists, as they're now called, population. So counter-terrorism, but much of it is taking on a political bent, dissidents against the system.
It's interesting that they say that there are a number of categories for this competition, which will focus on innovation and collaborative working. And that's really where we seem to see this all going. It's not the best. Now, just a quick reminder that tonight is the UK Column meeting in the George in Plimpton. Begins at 7:30. Get along to that if you possibly can. And then tomorrow evening, media on trial at this is Room Stop Wars event at the Bloomsbury Central Baptist Church. Not very many tickets left, it has to be said, for this now. It's incredible, the response so far. But do get along to it if you can. Details on eventbrite.com. David, the Israeli army raids multiple Palestinian media outlets in what I think you believe is a shutdown of free speech in Israel.
Well, that's the concern, certainly. The explanation given may be familiar to you. Let me give you word for word. The Israeli army said media companies raided by joint forces of the IDF, Shin Bet, that's the security service, equivalent of MI5, and the civil administration are suspected of distributing incitement materials, and that Israel will, quote, continue to take action against incitement to terror because it leads directly to terrorist attacks. So the critical thing is where you draw the line. Right. If you are talking about people who are genuinely inciting terror attacks, that's one thing. But we have to be careful, and we have to be careful as a society that line is drawn as tightly as possible. Otherwise, free speech is just eroded away. And when you hear the Prime Minister of Great Britain, former Prime Minister of Great Britain, saying things like, for too long we have been a passively tolerant society saying to our people, as long as you obey the law, we will leave you alone. It's very chilling when you see people starting to kick down doors into media organisations and arrest journalists because of things they are writing. Where's the oversight? Where's the checks and balances here? It's very concerning.
Right. Look, we don't have time to go into this in detail, but I'm just interested in your thoughts. Jacob Rothschild writing in the Times today about how proud we can as a nation in Britain of helping to create Israel. As I say, unfortunately, we would need a bit more time to go into any detail on this. But have you any thoughts about whether we should be proud of that, David, or not?
Well, look what the Balfour Declaration actually says. Right? It says it was going to create a Jewish national home at an economically sustainable rate and without in any way contravening the rights of the existing population. Now, if that had been still the policy there, if there wasn't ethnic cleansing and massive theft of assets, of land, then it would be a different world. Yeah,
indeed. Okay, Alex, Dutch and Belgian murders, what are the parallels?
Within a week of each other, two ladies in their mid-20s were gruesomely raped and murdered, and there were one was in the Netherlands and one was in Belgium. You can see the two articles on the screen here, the Telegraph reporting from the Netherlands and the Antwerp Gazette reporting the Belgian case. And in both cases, the justice system was openly and incontrovertibly guilty. In the left, you can see the word petition in the headline, and that's because a mother of three daughters unrelated to the victim started a petition in disgust. I've put a quotation at the bottom as why she did it. And that's been signed, when I checked this morning, by over 400,000 people, which is getting on for 5% of the adult population of the country in the Netherlands, because the suspect in this had gone to prison in 2011. The judge said he needs to go away for as long as possible to protect the public because he said he was proud of the rapes and murders of minors he'd committed at the time. And then he was sent off to be observed by psychiatrists, who are afraid much beloved of the Dutch system, to see whether he constituted an ongoing risk to society. And because he refused to cooperate, knowing that if he was sectioned, he would get an open-ended sentence, he just clammed up. The psychiatrists wrote a report saying we can't analyse him properly because he's not cooperative. And as a result, the court said, well, we're not going to section him then and let him out. And this is what happened. On the right, we have a case of a man who did something perverted to previous victims, went away for several years each time. And this time he was given care in the community. And as with the man in the case on the left, was released step by step back into the community and found the first opportunity to murder his young neighbour girl. And this is rather looking like a systemic fault in all of the more liberal Northwest European countries, actually, going on for decades. But particularly in the Benelux cases, you can see how arrogant the courts, the nexus is between the courts and the professional psychiatrists. In the case of this Dutch case, it was the Utrecht Clinic who's named in the petition. So they're actually going to get a printout of 400,000, nearly half a million names landing on their doorstep, which is pretty unprecedented. Whether anything changes remains to be seen, but Benelux has had enough of this now.
Okay, well, the question is, will a referendum be used in the Netherlands to change any law in the future?
This was pretty poetic justice. The Council of State in the Napoleonic model of government sits between the two houses of parliament and basically acts like the law lords and decides what's constitutional and what legislation has to be thrown out. And a couple of years ago, because it was a good thing to be populist then, one of the parties then angling for government, D66, said it would support a referendum bill, which went through and became a law. Now D66 is in this interminably thrashed out cabinet, which has finally come into being, so that the government has a rude awakening with that petition as well. And the first thing they do is they say, well, because D66 is in the coalition and they've changed their minds about the plebs having a vote, we're going to revoke, we're going to repeal the referendum bill of referendum act of 2015. And of course, some bright spark put this to the Council of State, which tests the lawfulness of statutes and bills, rather, in the Netherlands. And they said, well, there's no reason why repeal bills should be excluded. So the proposal of abolishing referendum in the Netherlands is going to have to be put to a referendum.
Well, that's the irony there is amazing. And finally, because the farce continues, but this time in Ireland.
Here we have faults on two sides. We have the new Taoiseach, Prime Minister of the Republic of Ireland, Leo Varadkar, a very controversial young and questionable character. deciding that his office is going to send out by Twitter an instruction to Ireland, which regularly in October has pretty much the Western world's strongest winds and manages to cope, saying all schools and colleges are to close. And believe it or not, Dublin City University is sitting on Twitter, or their social media people are, and think that the best thing to do is to tweet the Prime Minister back with the Irish public watching, saying, can you please confirm whether we are a college or not? And it's just beyond parody, isn't it? But it shows where we've got to in not just Ireland, but the whole of the Western world, I think. Yes.
And David, let's talk about this death of a journalist in Panama, linked to the Panama Papers. What are your thoughts on this?
I think this is one for you, Mike, actually. I don't, that wasn't one that I'd looked out specifically, but we were talking about other other deaths in journalists, so perhaps you could comment on that.
Well, I mean, I don't know too much about why she was killed, other than she made this statement. There are crooks everywhere you look. The situation is desperate. This was apparently the last thing she wrote before she was killed. Of course, she was leading the Panama Papers expose, and as a result, there were some some ructions within the Maltese government, with the Prime Minister having to resign and so on. So, you know, whether this goes beyond internal Maltese politics, or whether it's something bigger with regard to the Panama Papers, I'm not sure.
Yes, no, I had that quote in mind. Sorry, when I thought that stood out very dramatically. There are crooks everywhere you look. The situation is desperate. The reason I thought it stood out dramatically is it rather describes our situation. Although I don't think we're dealing with crooks. I think it's actually worse here. There's crooks, and there are people surrendering any idea of right and wrong. The Malta killing was related very much, as you were discussing yesterday, to private banks and the influence of money laundering through these smaller countries such as Malta and Cyprus, and it's extremely concerning.
Is this an example of money laundering through smaller countries? Because Nicola Sturgeon's universal basic income plan has been costed now at £12.3 billion. Where is she going to get the money?
This is an example of complete idiocy, I think, actually. Yes, we've covered this in an article on the UK column. We've looked at the origin of the universal basic income. And yes, that's the article there. And it comes back, it goes all the way back to the 60s. And the idea there was, well, there's this revolutionary new technology. It's called a computer. And once we have computers, we'll have nothing to do. There won't be any work to do because, you know, all the accountants will be out of a job. And you won't have any office work, so we're going to have to just sort of invent money and distribute it, because it's all we can do. Now, you may not have realised, but there's still things to do, even with computers. And the whole idea is based on nothing. Now, Nicola Sturgeon has adopted this, or at least said that they're looking into it, because the idea of free money is obviously a bit of a vote winner. Unfortunately, it is enormously expensive. It's been estimated at $12.3 billion. That's the extra, $12.3 billion extra, only in Scotland each and every single year. And that would mean, obviously, the complete flattening of the entire economy under a tax burden that's completely unsustainable.
Hold on. Right, this is universal basic income. Nobody's paying tax.
Well, to pay for this, the tax rate they're talking about is 50% on all tax bands. So that's 50% whatever you're earning. And the idea of having an allowance, a tax allowance, that goes as well. So basically, if you earn a single pound, the first pound that you earn that month, the government will come along and they will steal 50 pence.
Does that include the universal basic income itself?
And they'll give some of it back to you. They'll very generously give some of it back to you, yes. Now, the idea that you've got any incentive left to do anything is quite ridiculous, and it just shows you how loopy the whole idea is. But it is being looked at by the Scottish Government, and we will have to demolish it again. I hope people go and look at the old article and see just how ridiculous it is. We did quote in that Murray Rothbard, who described the state as a gang of thieves writ large, the most immoral, grasping and unscrupulous individuals in any society. Rather like that.
Yeah. Okay, well, just briefly, I wanted to mention, this was from the Wall Street Journal yesterday, that George Soros has decided to transfer $18 billion to Open Society Foundations, they say creating an instant giant. Brian, you said this morning, this is like in a game of poker, somebody going all in.
I think this is a sign that somebody is getting desperate with how they see the situation. They want massive influence. It's now or never. So, yeah, he's pushing that huge stash across the table and into the pot.
Yeah.
Let's remember, of course, that I think Open Society a little while back was funded to the tune of $1.9 billion. So it wasn't exactly small. And this is the source of the power which is producing all of these aggressive non-governmental organisations and charities and other foundations which are being used to destabilise Eastern Europe. They were at work in Kazakhstan, of course, and it took the Russians to say, well, we've had enough of this, and to throw some of these organisations out of Russia and Moscow, including the British Council, of course. But Soros, immensely dangerous man, we could say simply because of the amount of money that he's got.
We're running out of time, but we can discuss this one. CIA urges Trump to delay release of 3,000 never-before-seen documents on the JFK assassination.
It will be interesting to see what happens. Will Mr. Trump allow this to happen? Maybe if he wants to survive, it'd be a good idea to do it, because it'd start to shine a light on the death of Kennedy.
David?
And let's be clear what they mean by delay. Another 25 years hidden away in the files. Trump was quite clear in this as a candidate. It will be quite telling as to whether he actually acts to block the release of this information. There must be something in there the CIA don't want you to know.
I mean, Trump has been was quite clear as a candidate that he would be non-interventionist, and yet we seem to be moving in the direction of intervening in other countries, at least the US does. So I wonder how much of what he said as a candidate is actually going to come to fruition.
This is a very good point, Mike. The point where Trump ceased to be entertaining, ceased to be, I suppose, an item which generated some hope, was the missile attack on Syria. That's where he sold out. That's where the Trump the candidate and Trump the president were shown to be different.
Yeah.
But we will watch to see what happens here.
Okay, well, let's end on the subject of money, because this seems to be where we need to focus. How many people, I wonder, were aware of this organisation, UKGI, the UK Government Investments, is the government's centre of expertise in corporate finance and corporate governance. I'm not sure whether the corporate governance is referring to UK government, but it's very interesting to see how this is panning out. So it's a limited company that began operating on the 1st of April 2016, wholly owned by the by HM Treasury. And what else can we tell you? Well, these are some of the objectives of it: to prepare and execute all significant corporate asset sales by the UK government. I thought you'd be interested in that one, Mike, because when you asked the Treasury for the list of assets that have been sold to date, they said, oh, we're not able to provide that.
Well, indeed they did. They said they don't hold that information, which is quite incredible. We are still in the midst of what George Osborne called the greatest privatisation since the Second World War, I guess. I mean, I don't know when we've seen a greater privatisation of assets in this country. And they're not telling anybody what they're selling and how much money they're raising from it.
No, they're not. So encourage people to go and have a look at this on the internet. It's on the government side, of course. So there we are. It's a government company with HM Treasury as its sole shareholder. Activities underpinned by its Articles of Association and framework agreed by HM Treasury. Accountable to the Board of Treasury Ministers and through the Chancellor to Parliament. So you can clearly trust this company. It's got a board. I haven't got time to show you all of the people, but you can go and have a look. Quite interested in this man, non-executive chairman. And he was originally working with private banking, investment banking, asset management, Credit Suisse, Warburg. So this is a banker put in charge. And I thought we could ask him where those public assets have gone, Mike. That might be interesting.
Yes.
And I just picked another man because, of course, this is independent, this organisation. The other gentleman that I've shown you, Senior Independent Director of Prudential PLC, M&G Group, Chairman of City of London Investment Trust, Severn Trent PLC, Deputy Chairman of the Takeover Panel. And he's done a little bit of investment banking with BZW Kleinwort Benson. So the government's put bankers in charge of the sell-off of our public assets. We haven't got a record of those assets, but don't worry because it's all independent.
There we go.
There we go. Alex, I'll just give you the last word on anything for a couple of seconds before we close.
UKGI there describes itself as the government centre of excellence in corporate finance. That is the old-fashioned, stuffier City of London term for what's now usually called mergers and acquisitions. In other words, leveraged buyouts and the like. City sharp practice. And as Mike reported yesterday, the statutes on that have just been tightened up. So it looks like the cabal is going to go into business openly, including those with government and ex-government positions, and basically just start trading, buying and selling things on behalf of themselves. Not on behalf of the nation. And as regards why Soros is in an awful hurry to start a new currency system, a couple of sources I'd recommend. On YouTube, there is X22 report and SGT report, and they both report on why the cabal has run out of road with its model. And finally, you should look out on Brittany Pettibone's channel, a very popular one on YouTube, for a video last month by a guy called Nick Monroe, who goes into Soros in great depth. And I believe he's planning a sequel which promises to be even more comprehensive. So look out for Nick Monroe on Brittany Pettibone's channel.
Okay. Thank you, Alex.
That's it for today.
It is.
We're going to thank David and Alex for joining us. And I think the picture in UK is unfolding pretty quickly. The banks are there in the middle of our governance and need to be exposed pretty quickly. And Mike, you're away for tomorrow?
We're away for the next 2 days, but we've got some pre-recorded special UK column news programmes to play out. So we will have a new news programme for you tomorrow. It just won't be live at the usual time, 1 o'clock, yeah. And the same for Friday.
And that, of course, is so that you can do the filming for the Media on Trial event,
absolutely,
which we think is so important that Mike's committed his time. So that's it, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to our audience today. And if you're not a subscriber to Use UK Column, please consider subscribing or donating. We can only do what we do with your financial help. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. All right.